Hello and welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. I am Andrew Hansen.
And I'm Lauren Fox.
And you're hearing my voice first this week because I'm in the studio and Lauren is on the road. Lauren, tell our listeners where you're at today.
I wish I was somewhere more exciting. I feel like it's the opposite day. We started the show off backwards. I am at a campground in New York State for a 13U baseball tournament. So there are teams from all over the region up here. We're here with a team that is Goffstown, Bedford, that general area, and just kind of experiencing what it's like and seeing some of the talent. And showed up the field yesterday. What I didn't realize walking out to the field yesterday was the fact that the first game was an 18U game. So you're talking about largely high school varsity players. And the kids are throwing about as hard as, like, perfect throws. They're throwing upper 80s, low 90s. They're a hair bigger. There was a play almost made by the center fielder of one of the teams that would have, had it been made, been number one play on ESPN for the night. Just an amazing attempt at a catch. It was a ball that had no right to even play to be on it. And he got there, dove, hit the heel of his glove, so he actually dove past the ball a little bit, and it came out. But some of the talent that we saw out there was very good. Just some fun ball players, and I walked out there and I thought that it was a 13U team. Like, oh my God, there's no way our kids are hang with this. And
right.
And asked one of the scorers, "Hey, what age group is this?" He says, "It's 18U." I said, "I feel better now."
Phew.
That's yeah, that would have been a interesting one to go up against. But no, it's these are kids who a large number of the kids that are on the team that Maggie plays on were on that state championship team with Goffstown last year.
Okay.
And so these are kids who have been through the progression that the Bedford kids are going through now, where they are experiencing these guys did experience the opportunity to win a district, to win the state, came very close to going to Williamsport, within a strike of going to Williamsport, although I can't say that too loud in this group because somebody will hear me and I'll get the side eye. But these kids, it's funny to hear them talk. I mean, they can talk about playing in Bristol. They can talk about being on ESPN. And, those are memories that they'll all share. And hopefully those are memories that the Bedford 12s we'll wind up getting to share as well.
That's right. And it is that time of year, isn't it? We had the pleasure of calling Bedford's 12 and under all-star game against Goffstown earlier this week. We're taping this on Friday.
Yep.
And that was the winner's bracket game between Bedford and Goffstown. And for those who missed it, Bedford won an exciting 5-3 game down in Salem. And the star on the hill that day was Patrick Fullis, and we were both really impressed with how he performed, weren't we?
Yes, it was fun to watch Patrick. He is, so with the age changes, and we had talked about some of this stuff on the air, last year's Little League team was a strange one in that it had a 16-month year. So the age cutoff went from May 1st of 2005 to August 31st of 2006. And the reason Little League did that was to accommodate a truly 12-year-old player, because what they were tired of and tired of seeing on the broadcast was a bunch of kids playing in the ages listed as 13 when Little League is supposed to be 12-year-old. So Little League made the decision, I'm going to say 4 or 5 years ago, to change up their year. And as a result, there are kids who effectively lost the year of Little League. And on the other end of the spectrum, like Henry Dubois, is one who effectively lost the year of Little League. He's 11, going on 12. And he will be done with Little League for all intents and purposes by the time he's 12 years old. But last year's group was a 16-month group. This year's group is a 12-month group. So you have Patrick, who is on the older end of that spectrum, where he's basically, he beat that cutoff by a couple weeks. So he's 12, closer to 13. And he pitches with a good deal of maturity. And it's funny You know, I remember coaching him and coaching against him for years, and he's a cerebral ball player, and he really is like a coach on the field in a lot of ways, very intense player, and he's an intense but has an absolute love and respect for the game. So you see him get out there the other day with the knowledge of the gravity of the situation where I know that last year's Bedford team didn't beat Goffstown. The year before, in 2017, they may have beaten Goffstown once. I'm not entirely certain. And it usually comes down to these two, and we talked about it. So, Patrick knew what the situation was, knew that he had to get his team a win, and pitched very well, with the exception of the third inning where he threw about 34 pitches. And even with that, there was a little bit of luck involved in giving Goffstown a longer inning time. But it set him up where he went 5 1/3 and turned the ball over to Matt Ulisny, who's from Amherst. Matt pitched. That's a good pitcher. He's been around for a couple of years at Bedford Little League. And, just a good ball player. Handles that very well. Matt pitched well. It was kind of one of those innings where you sort of feel like, all right, what's going to happen next? And ultimately what happened was he wound up getting the final out, but it was Goffstown sort of chipping into that Bedford lead until ultimately the go-ahead run would have been in place. Bedford still had a chance to answer in the bottom of the inning. But it offered a lot of excitement. And for Bedford, too, it gave them a little bit of redemption. The week before, they had lost to Goffstown. Adam LaFond, who's a big lefty, had been on the hill for Goffstown and had pitched very well. This time, it was a couple walks that in that first inning that really were LaFond's demise or contributed to it. He gave up 4 runs in the first inning, and Goffstown wound up shutting him down he hit 39 pitches, but reverted back to where he started that final batter, Alex St. Hilaire. So they had the opportunity to use him again, and I'd be confident that's who Bedford would see on Saturday. So it should be a good matchup. Wish I could be there. Wish we could be doing the game on radio.
Yeah, that's right. Our understanding is that Goffstown won this week, so they've set up a rematch on Saturday. And the situation there is, since it's double elimination, Goffstown will have to beat Bedford twice in a row. So they'll have to win on Saturday and then win again. So that puts Bedford in a great position. And we very, very well may see that same pitching matchup of Fullis against LaFond. And I'm looking back at the scorebook from that game. And, you know, the interesting thing is, if you missed the broadcast, Goffstown is the 1 seed. Bedford is the 2 seed. But Bedford was the home team because there's a coin flip before each game to determine who's going to be the home team. And so the pressure was on Fullis to go out and throw up a 0 in that top of the first with Goffstown batting. And that's what he did. He started the game off with a strikeout against that pitcher for Goffstown, Adam LaFond. Big left-handed, strong hitter. So he really got the momentum started for Bedford by striking out 2 in the first inning, throwing up a 0. Then Bedford comes back and scores 4 in the bottom of the first, like you mentioned. And then he just cruised from there. You know, he ended up with 9 strikeouts in that 5 1/3 innings. And then when Ulisny was pitching in the 6th, he had to come in because of the pitch limit, the 85-pitch pitch limit for this age group. And you mentioned how there were runners on base, but I was just really surprised by how he battled his poise, because the game was on the line. You could see him grinding under the pressure, but he really came to the forefront and got that strikeout against Goffstown's number 9 hitter to end the game.
Yeah, it was impressive to see. He's one who, we saw him play in his 11-year-old season, during the regular season as well as during district play. And, he is a kid that you can really put anywhere on the field. He, the best way to say it, as far as that goes, is he's businesslike. He handles things professionally. Like, he knows what he's doing. And he did a great job back there behind the plate for most of the game when it became evident that he entered that 6th inning with 82 pitches. He was only going to face a batter, maybe 2 if he got lucky. So they moved Matt to second base with the idea that they just have him flip right over, and they knew what they were going to do on defense. At that point, they had Henry Dubois back behind the plate. He did a great job back there, too. But it's nice to have, at this age, kids who you can sort of put anywhere. It really is a luxury, and Matt is one who's not afraid to have the ball, handles the bat well. Like, you know, this at this point, a lot of these kids have been through these pressure situations, and they're comfortable with it. And it's that not only helps them for their baseball career, but it helps them with other things. Builds confidence in school. You know, so there are people who say, well, what does sports have to do with anything? Why is that emphasis placed on it? Well, there are other things intrinsically that, that go along with athletic performance. And you can see that with some of these kids where, hey, they have dealt with some, you know, some complicated things on the field. So somebody throwing the bat that isn't really going to matter.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You certainly learn so much from athletics, especially as a youth, with the success and the failure. And, you know, when we saw that on the field, you're right, there was a lot of defensive movement. But offensively, the thing that really jumped out at me was, you know, again, this was a pressure game against a rival. And I thought a lot of these kids had really great at-bats. I mean, they were going deep into the count. Sometimes you'd see a kid with two strikes, foul three or four off, and extend the at-bat and wear down the opposing pitcher. And I thought it was just a really impressive performance, 1 through 9, with their approach at the plate.
Well, the value that's put on, okay, so if it's, to get everybody kind of up to speed, if you stay under 20 pitches, so if you start your final batter under 20, you can come back and throw the next day. You can't have a pitcher throw 3 days in a row. 35 is the benchmark at which you have to sit 1 day. 50 is mark 2, 65 is 3, anything over 65 is 4 day rest. And so there's really a premium placed on autonomy. Yeah, you know, it's really nice to have a pitcher who goes out there and strikes everything out. But at the end of the day, you're going to strike everything out. And with three pitches per 54, you're going to throw balls in there. The kids. So the more strikeouts you get, strikeouts are kind of an inefficient way to get it out. You know, you're talking 4 or 5 pitches per. So, all right, for Patrick, I don't know where the count is, but I'm going to guess he threw somewhere in the 45, 50 pitches to get those 9 out. That's all gone. Strikeouts are nice because it's done. You know, you just get the out of it. But in Bedford's case, even like with Alex St. Clair in that last at-bat in the first inning, Alex saw 7 pitches. You know, if you can spoil a couple pitches for a pitcher, that really makes a big impact on a game. It play out down the line. And it really seemed as if the Bedford team was conscious of that when they were going after that. Like, hey, here's a way that we can get, and we were joking about it, and the game changer app that a lot of teams use to track stats and scoring. It awards you what's called a quality at bat, a quality. If you foul off a pitch with 2 strikes, if you go to the train, you can come. If you hit a ball hard, but, you know, the kids aren't looking at it, but there are enough of them to know what a swap is. And so, like, they're aware too. Like, these are kids in a lot of ways who are starting to grow up. And, you know, they know how the game works. They're smarter than we give them credit.
Absolutely. So, as you look ahead to the schedule, as we mentioned, Goffstown will be playing Bedford again on Saturday. If you're listening to this Saturday morning, they play at 4 o'clock. So get out and check out that game if you can. And then
it's at Goffstown as well.
Right. So, it's at Goffstown.
Yeah.
And then.
But Bedford could theoretically be the home.
Right. Right. And so depending on how that goes, perhaps we'll have a chance to broadcast one of the later games. Or if they win down the road. So stay tuned and check your local listings for that broadcast.
Yeah, I hope so. It is a lot of fun to do that. You know, I think about when Bedford hosted the state championship in 2015 and then they wound up winning in 2016. It really is a lot of fun. I don't know who's hosting the state championship this year, but it really is. And, you know, just it's fun to watch the kids, and it's, you know, sometimes they realize the pressure environment and they just feel. And sometimes they realize the pressure environment and they just speak too much and you go, ah, it was too much for a 12-year-old kid. It's a great experience for them. And, you know, hopefully we have the experience to do some of those games as well.
Right. So there's your Little League update. Now, give us the tournament update from New York, because I know, it's Friday morning, and a lot of times you're traveling on Friday for these tournaments for Saturday, Sunday, but you were traveling Thursday. You had a game this morning, correct? How did that one go?
Played yesterday, played today. Today they played against the team. I think I haven't gotten the straight skinny on whether it was Massachusetts or Connecticut, but regardless, they had a kid who looked like Jeff Weaver on the mound, didn't throw unlike him, and they wound up, they were trailing 4-2, and then a couple misplays, mental mistakes, again, 13-year-old kids. The final outcome was not close to 4-2. They played yesterday as well, but because the hard thing, I'm used to going for softball tournaments, where softball tournaments, you play maybe Friday night, but definitely all day Saturday for pool play, and then you get seated, you play your tournament on Sunday. With baseball, you don't have the luxury to do with softball, which is to say your pitchers come back on 0 days rest or hours rest. With baseball, like typically, unless somebody throws 50 pitches, you don't want them. And so with the baseball tournaments, they tend to be a bit more protracted, so that theoretically you could throw an ace on Thursday and throw him again on Saturday. So, we'll see. It's been fun to see. My latest thing that I feel like I'm saying at 5 times a day is the game teaches you what you need to learn. And, in this case, you go through and you play a game and you realize, okay, this is what either my kid and I need to work on or the team needs to work on. In fact, if I'm not coaching, but the coaches who are if these guys were going out and playing teams that were markedly worse than them, you don't actually learn anything. You get the, hey, great, we beat somebody and it feels good. Playing up a little bit, playing against better teams, is a way to really figure out what you have to work on for the next practice. And at this age, that's what you want. You want to look back there and I've improved week after week. This is where I started the season and this is where I am.
Lots of learning experiences for sure. So,
dude, yes.
So if you're just joining
too
us,
many.
Lauren is joining us from the road this week in New York. The last time we did this, he was down in New Orleans, but
that was way better.
This week he's in New York, and one thing that I noticed was you mentioned that you're with this other group of parents who are staying in this campground, and the other big event you mentioned, trying to recover from Thursday to play Friday. The other event that folks are watching currently, where the competitors are trying to recover from Thursday to then perform well on Friday, is the Open Championship over in Northern Ireland.
Yep.
And it was funny. I noticed on part of the broadcast that there is a camping village over there, and some of the media members are staying in that campground. So a little bit different conditions there over there, because temperatures there are in the low 60s, lots of rain and wind, whereas over here in Northeast, we're looking at 98, 99 this weekend. So a little bit different challenge to be over there at that campground and for those participants to be playing in those conditions.
And my question is, why did we not get press passes to go and do that?
I know. We got to start planning ahead for one of these open championships in the coming years. A little bit of a different travel logistics to get over there than to get to St. Louis or to get to the PGA Championship down on Long Island, which we consider doing. But that would be a once-in-a-lifetime experience for sure.
Oh, my God. Oh, hopefully more than once. But yeah. So it was, speaking of layoffs and whatnot, it's interesting. Tiger went out and got it. And injuries that caused him to miss a lot of time appear to sort of still be there. It's really not an easy sport to come back, particularly after you've been off for a bit. So not a good first round. You know, I guess things could be worse, though. He could be David Duvall, who shot a 91 yesterday, shot a 14 on one hole.
Yeah, and I wanted to go through that hole because that was just amazing. The recap on that, because you know, I was checking the scores and I saw that he was basically in last place. And so then I looked at his scorecard, and at that point it said he had a 13 on one of the holes. And normally on these websites like PGAtour.com, you can look at the hole and it give you a play-by-play of how they went about getting their score on that hole. But for some reason on the Open Championship on the PGAtour.com website, they don't have the play-by-play. So it wasn't until Friday, today, where there were stories written about this hole that David Duvall had that we could find out how he did it if you didn't see it on the broadcast. And so for those who missed it, the way that he got that score was he hit a ball, thought it might be lost, so he hits a provisional off the tee, thought that one might be lost, so he hits another provisional off the tee, which would have been his fifth. So he goes down, and the marshals help him find the ball. He hits his fifth. It's up by the green. He goes up and gets ready to hit his sixth at the green, but then he realized it's the wrong Titleist two. It was not his ball. He had played the wrong ball. So now it's a two-stroke penalty. He's at eight, but he has to go all the way back to the tee. So now he's hitting his eighth shot off the tee, and it takes him six more shots, and he ends up getting a 14. And this is in a round where he started off birdieing one and two. So he goes one and two, birdies one and two, but then he gets a 14 on a par four, and he ends up shooting a 91, which I believe is the worst round of his career. He'd shot around 85 a couple times in the British Open with bad weather. But for a guy who's won a major, he's won the Open Championship before, that just shows you how crazy golf is, especially in the Open Championship, where a guy who's playing well, decent form, birdies one and two, can go out and shoot a 14.
Yeah, the thing that I didn't quite get out of that is, like, it's not like he's playing at Deerfield Country Club and people are just whacking golf balls from all over the place. Like, he's playing at the British Open. How is it possible that there would just be another random Titleist two just lurking out there?
I know. Well, you know, the thing is, they're playing at Royal Portrush, which is, if you haven't watched, it is an absolutely beautiful location for golf. It's just incredible. But like most Open Championship courses, there's deep rough every which way, everywhere you turn. But there are regular members at that course who've been playing. And so perhaps it was a regular member's ball, or maybe it was someone else from earlier in the round, one of the professionals who'd lost his ball. Because, you know, if you watch it for 5 minutes, you see a ball go into the rough. Sometimes it's easy to find. Sometimes it's 5 or 6 inches down in deep grass, and you have 20 people there looking for the ball for 3 minutes, and nobody can find it. In fact, that happened to Graham McDowell, who's one of the local favorites from Northern Ireland, and he was going along really well in the first round. I believe he was one under on the 18th hole, and he hits his approach shot up around the green, and they spent the 3 minutes. That's the new rule. You have 3 minutes to look for the ball instead of five. And they had about 20 people looking for it, just crisscrossing the rough, and they couldn't find it. So he had to go back and play a ball for a lost ball, which is just, it is surprising in this day and age. You know, in the regular PGA Tour event, you almost never see a lost ball in the rough because the rough just isn't that deep, and you've got all the marshals and the fans out there looking for it. But specifically in the Open Championship, because of the actual conditions of that rough, you know, you can have 15, 20 people looking for it and lose the ball. And so maybe with Duvall, it was one of those situations where it was just in an area where a lot of guys, if they're going to miss the fairway, that's where they miss with their tee ball. And so he found the wrong Titleist too. And he said, you know, it was on him. He said he just hadn't marked it well enough or checked it well enough for his markings to identify it properly.
The funny thing when you think about it is, so he won his only major in 2001 when he won the Open. And He's won 13 championships in his career. But he basically fell off the golf radar at that point. He's still, by golf standards, relatively young, 47 years old, and taking advantage of the fact that he has an exemption. So, making it to 60, playing the British Open. So, he'll keep playing. Because he can, but it has to be very tough to be an elite athlete, elite golfer, and then all of a sudden, for whatever reason, just sort of lose it. You get out there, you think you found it, and then you basically almost go double snowman and wind up getting yourself out of contention and go from quickly, all right, maybe I have a shot at this, too, now there's no way that I can make the cut. So I didn't get to see it this morning. I thought Koepka was making a run, but what does the leaderboard look like now?
So the story of day two, and again, we're taping this late Friday morning, so about half the field is yet to play, but Shane Lowry is just on a tear. He's from Ireland, so this is pretty much home soil for him. He's at 10 under on the leaderboard. I believe he was 5 under through 10 today. Just on point, you know, tee to green, making all his putts. He hit a couple long ones, and the crowd is really getting behind him. And so he's the man to beat right now. He's at 10 under, and Koepka finished at 5 under after his second round. But That's one of the big stories this week is the fact that the event is being held in Northern Ireland. It hasn't been there for 68 years.
Yep.
So
obviously there's political strife and all that stuff.
Right. So they finally got that sorted out, and Royal Port Rush, which is where the event was held in 1951, they got the course up to modern standards, really. And you go back to the media, what they had to do was they had to take out the 17th and 18th holes to build the media center and some of the other infrastructure that goes into hosting one of these championships. So they had to build two new holes. I believe it was 6 and 7 or 7 and 8. And so the amazing thing is they built these two new holes for this championship, and a lot of the players didn't know that they were new holes. They went over there and said, wow, I love this seventh hole. And they had done such a great job of making it look like one of the old school holes that the players didn't know it. And they also, to a man, it seems like they all love this course, which is really refreshing. We just got done with the U.S. Open, and of course, there's always the controversy there of,
oh, green is too fast, the rough is too thin.
Right. Everybody,
yeah, the water's
everybody,
too wet.
Yeah, the water's too wet, exactly. Everybody, that's the main topic of discussion is, what are the folks at the USGA going to do to this course? Are they going to ruin it and make it brutally unplayable?
Right.
But you don't have that at the Open Championship, and this year, they all love this course.
Yeah, and from experience firsthand, like how hard it is to build golf holes. it's an undertaking to do that, and requires a lot of planning. And no doubt, I'm sure there's geological surveys and you name it. So there's a lot that needs to go into that in order to make that happen. But I'm bummed out. It's another, bummed out. You're not gonna be able to watch a whole lot of that. Being up here in the sticks, but I'm who's your money on that? Who's your guy?
Well, I mean, Lowry, you know, the big question with a lot of these, the biggest question coming in was, how is Rory McIlroy going to play because of the home course advantage? And we'll talk about that here in a minute. But he's from Northern Ireland. He played on that course as a kid. And so everybody thought, well, he knows it better than anyone. He's been playing very well this year, so he's the favorite. But it seemed like in the first round, the pressure really got to him. He shot a 79. But, Shane Lowry, it seems like he's navigated it perfectly. He's just comfortable and excited, and his game is clicking. So, I mean, right now, it's easy to say, who do you pick? Well, I pick the guy who's ahead, but certainly wouldn't count Koepka out.
I was just going to say him.
Even if he ends the second round 4 or 5 behind Lowry, I mean, you can't can't rule him out. He looked like he was dialed in the first round yesterday, you know, hitting his pitch shots to like 6 inches. So he's just, he's on top of his game. But yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about Rory, because there's so much made about the event being in Northern Ireland, the course he grew up on. And Sarah asked me this week, you know, how is it that golfers can shoot scores that are so different from one day to the next? And there's no better example of discussing that topic than looking at Rory McIlroy, because when he played on this course as a 16-year-old, he shot a 61. And they did an interview. They showed an interview of him after that round as a 16-year-old, and it was just really fun to see him at that age. But he said it was the first round he'd ever shot without a bogey. He finished with 5 straight birdies to shoot that 61. So just an incredible round. And so this is the course he comes in ready to play. He shot a 61 as a kid on this course, but he shoots a 79 on the opening round, because on the first hole, he pulls his drive out of bounds. Then he hits his second drive into the rough, hits his approach shot up to the green into the rough, has to take an unplayable lie, chips on the green, misses like a 6-foot putt, and taps in for a quad. And, you know, he finishes the day with a double bogey, I think. So he just started terribly, finished terribly. And it just goes to show you how, first of all, how different your game can be from one day to the next, but also just how much of a physical and mental challenge it is, because he was dealing with so much pressure playing on that course that he grew up on playing on, and everybody expecting him to win the Open.
The question that I have, and you follow this way more closely than I do, in thinking about players like him who were seemingly like on top of the world a couple of years ago, Jordan Spieth, another one who was rolling, and it looked when he was 20, 21, 22, it was like he was going to control the tour for a long time. He's sort of regressed to the mean a little bit. What causes guys to, and it's not that the competition caught up to them, it's that they've, again, regressed to the mean. So what causes that?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you know, I guess you can look at that on a day-to-day scale or on a year-to-year scale. And that's the thing I was trying to describe to Sari is, of course, people who play a lot of golf know that there are so many variables with the golf swing, your stance, your takeaway, your follow-through, your grip, that, and not to mention your body, how it feels, that it's just so hard to be consistent day-to-day. And then, not to mention year to year, where, you know, it's just hard. Spieth has been known as such a great putter. And so that if he's relying on that and then he starts to struggle a little bit and then you tinker with your approach and then you get into a slump and that's what happened. That's what has happened to him. He hasn't won since he won the Open Championship in 2017. But I just think in general, it could be physical or mental. And with Spieth, it seems like it's been more physical. He's been struggling with his tee to green game, but his putting is back. He actually is at 5 under, I believe, after 2 rounds. So he's actually playing well. And it does seem like a good event for him, because tee to green, you don't have to be perfect. You know, you can, there's so many different ways that if you can just get up to the green, then he can take advantage of his short game. And, you know, he's found the groove over there, because, of course, the putting is just not as difficult once you get on the green. The greens are a lot flatter and slower than a lot of the greens they play in the U.S.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I know there's variation of courses, but, you know, I would equate, like, Spieth being a pitcher, a finesse pitcher, all of a sudden struggling with control, and how do you get that back? And the more you focus on it, ultimately, the worse it gets, which is completely contrary to what you'd expect, but unfortunately, that's just how it rolls. Like, there really is a mental component to the game.
Yeah, and that's the other thing is, when you've had so much success like Spieth has had, and won so much at a young age, that if you then start to have the physical problems of tee to green, where you're just off, then when it becomes a slump, then it's not only a physical game, but now it's a mental challenge. And then you've got right. the media constantly questioning him. What are you working on? Are you improving? When are you going to win again? And then it's twice as hard because you've got the physical challenge and the mental. And he's been in that media battle now for a while, trying to convince everybody that he's got his game back. But I just think it goes back to confidence. He's got to find some confidence and fix the mental part there somehow, because you can't. You just can't overcome physical and mental challenges at the same time in golf and think you're going to contend. I mean, look at Brooks Koepka. He's got both of those down so well. He's obviously one of the strongest guys. He's got a great all-around game. But he comes into these tournaments with so much confidence, he's expecting to win. I mean, he's absolutely expecting to contend. And he thinks it's his to lose. It's sort of like Tiger back in the day. Where, you know, he came out expecting to win every time, and sometimes he would. He'd win several tournaments in a row, but that was the mental approach that he had going into it.
Right. It's but as you know, and we all know, confidence is a very thin thread to walk, and in a lot of cases, Koepka right now probably feels a lot like Jordan Spieth felt 16-17. And that can go in a second. It just is. It's the great ones, and this is going to segue us into the next topic. It's the great ones that can sustain it and figure out how to deal with that and kind of press through that. And the examples, there are three of them that we got to see at Wimbledon this week. Federer, Djokovic, and Rafael Nadal. And the three of those guys have been dominating on the men's side for years. And I mean, I don't know if you remember, I remember when Sampras set the record for the most majors won.
And yeah, of course.
That seemed like it was going to be a record that was going to stand for a while. And now, like, he's way back in the distance. I mean, this is like the equivalent of Nolan Ryan breaking Walter Kopp's strikeout record and striking out another 1,700 players.
Like right.
That's kind of where we are with this, with those three continuing to. It's funny. It's like the tournament is just a tune-up for when they face each other.
Yeah, when those three are healthy, you're expecting all three of them to be in the semifinals of every Grand Slam.
Oh, absolutely. And unless somebody messes with the seeding, but yeah.
Right, right. And you're right. Sampras got to 14, and then I think he lost a little. A little bit of his motivation because he was at the top of the pyramid, and there was no reason to think that people would fly past that number within 20 years. Because you know there aren't many guys who've won 10, and Sampras was at 14. But you're right. The last 15 years have been amazing. Federer is now at 20, if I remember correctly. Nadal is at 18, and Djokovic just got to 16. So all three of them are well past Sampras, and even though I think Federer is 37,
yeah.
And Nadal and Djokovic are in their early 30s,
yeah, 32.
There's no reason to think that for several more years, those guys are going to be adding to those totals.
Well, and really the thing that is the most impressive about it is, I don't remember who it was, who it might have been Federer to win his first major, Andy Roddick, in the final. Roddick has now been retired. Roddick is basically analogous to them as far as the age goes. He's been retired for 6 years.
Right.
So in a lot of cases, in Sampras you mentioned, there comes a point in time where some of these guys go, I've won a lot, and I'm at the top, like, I'm not going to get any better than this. And I have a wife at home, and we have young kids, and you know what? Like, that's it. I'm good. And these three are continuing to crank. I mean, even Djokovic is taking his little son around. Stefan, I think, is his name, and I wouldn't surprise you if he named him after Stefan Edberg.
Right.
He's taking his 5-year-old son around, and as a dad, you're sitting there thinking, I'm taking my kid around so that he'll remember this and appreciate it. And the kid's like, I'm so bored. I just want to go home. Like, I don't want anything to do. Like, you could see the kid, like, just begrudgingly, like, hey, I'm going to take you to see the, you know, the royal family, whatever. And you just, we've all been there. He just wasn't having it.
Right, yeah, I just, like, I have to sit here.
Do I have to, Dad?
Dad, I have to sit here and be quiet and use all these manners. This is not very fun.
This is not fun for a five-year-old. Like, and I get, they all, athletes all do it, press conferences, you name it. Hey, I want to have my kid here so he remembers it. Hey, how much of that will you actually remember? But, I don't know.
With Federer, that's the thing, is they showed his four kids, two sets of twins, the 10-year-old girls, the 5-year-old boys, and then I think his comment during the medal ceremony, the trophy ceremony, was that the kids weren't going to be very happy with the plate that he won. They wanted him to see the gold, the gold trophy, and he just won some silver plate. And it's just funny to see him put it in those terms of he's out there, you know, playing in front of his kids, and sort of how they think about it is, you know, Dad, are you going to hold the golden trophy or this little silver plate for second place?
And the prize money for winning that is more money than I'll ever make. And you look at that, all right, that's what adults think of. Like, he's going to bring home so much cash, or the prestige that goes along with it. Kids are like, what trophy are you bringing? What trophy are you bringing home? You know, and for him, all right, he's won 20 major championships. He's probably going to melt that down and make it. Like, really, what's the point?
Right.
What's the point of having that thing sticking around?
But right.
I'm out of shelf. It's not going to put up a second trophy.
Yeah, and so, you know, I'm curious what your thought process was while you're watching it, because for me, I've always had a high level of respect for Federer, the way that he plays, and the fact that he's doing it at this age when so many tennis players retire well before this age, especially since he has a big family. But I've never really rooted for him. I've always respected him. But this may have been the first time I find myself actually rooting for him, because it seemed like, you know, this might be, you know, you never know. This could be his last chance, or one of his last chances at Wimbledon for sure. I mean, maybe he'll push for the title at the U.S. Open, but there's not much left in his career, and I was kind of pulling for him to get one more, because, you know, Djokovic is right on his heels now.
Yes, I have been rooting for him for a while. Just because of how he goes about his business. He's a competitor. He prepares both mentally and physically. He really appears to genuinely love the game, love the pursuit. And I look at him, and I really feel like he sets a great example for any athlete in any of this is just how you go about your business. And, you know, we all want the storybook ending, right? You know, Tom Brady keeps coming back. Well, sorry, Patriots fan. Eventually, it's going to happen where he gets hurt and they have 5-11 season, and he just decides, I'm hanging up and this is how I'm going out. It doesn't always end with championships, unfortunately. So if you want to see that, but for a lot of these athletes, they are still thinking. For us as outsiders, it's easy for us to say, he's won it. That's a great number. He needs to stop. What he's doing, because he's still in shape and he's still one of the top three in the world, what he's doing is trying to get a win, put it out to you, so that Djokovic, when he decides he's done, he can't get to the number. When Nadal can't get to the number, that's really what he's trying to do at this point, make it so nobody can touch him. And
right.
He's not concerned about the ending because he's already written all the best chapters and more things.
Yeah, and you're right. He's going to write his own finish, and it sounds like you're starting to deal with some British Open wind over there, so see if you can get out of the wind. But the fascinating thing about the championship was, of course, that fifth set and how they changed the rules. And instead of Wimbledon going on for potentially
dozens of games in the fifth set, they put in a rule where this year, for the first time in the fifth set, they were going to stop it at 12-12 and play a tiebreaker. And it ended up being the first men's final in a Grand Slam to ever end in a tiebreaker. So it was a really fascinating finish and strategy and drama from 6-6 up to 12-12, wondering, you know, how is this going to play out? Are they going to get to this tiebreaker? And, of course, in between there, I believe it was 8-7, is when Federer actually had two match points. He's up 40-15. He's serving. His serve has been almost unbeatable for the entire tournament and the entire match. I mean, I don't think he'd lost his serve in the first three sets, but he'd lost the first and third set because he lost in a tiebreaker. So his serve had been almost untouchable, and here he is serving 40-15, 2 points to win the championship, and that first point he sort of hit that inside-out forehand, and it just went wide, and then Djokovic survives the second match point, and, you know, that was at the point where I actually felt a little bit bad for Federer. And you mentioned, you know, all the money he's won. He's won, I think, over $100 million. So it's hard to feel bad for a guy who's had that much success, made that much money. But to be that close, you know, when he's trying to get one more, I kind of felt bad for him. He wasn't able to put it away there.
Yeah, it is the first time I want to say 47 or 98 that somebody's which is unexpected considering him and his past. Like, that's uncharacteristic. But, it's part of the drama. It's part of the whole story that goes along with it, where those two, this isn't the last time they're going to battle against each other. And, it'll be fun to see how things continue to play out. I don't know, give it 2 or 3 years, Federer will be done. And then it'll be about the Joker's pursuit, and it'll be about, can Nadal catch up? Because they're all going up against the one opponent that nobody's ever beat.
What's that, Father Time?
Father Time, dude.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And you got to tip your cap to Djokovic. I mean, he is just such a battler. He was dealing with this Federer at his best on grass with his serve, and somehow he mentally fought through those two match points and found a way to win. I mean, it's just incredible what a warrior he is, you know, physically and mentally. Almost 5-hour match, longest in Wimbledon final history. These guys are just, I mean, you talk about the physical and mental side of golf. In tennis, I mean, they're not slouches when it comes to those two tests. I mean, 5 hours of tennis. Especially in hotter conditions, like you might find at the U.S. Open. But, I mean, that was excellent tennis for 5 hours.
Yeah, and I don't know. I haven't played much tennis in 20 years probably. You think about, all right, you go out and play for an hour, and you're toast. And I was in my 20s. I was in great shape. I could do anything, I'd be out until 3 in the morning and play 18 holes of golf and go surfing for a little. Like, I had what seemed like a boundless supply of energy. But even with that, you go play tennis for an hour and you wake up the next morning and your body's sore everywhere. What those guys were able to do, for how long they do it, and for being, again, their age in early to late 30s running spectrum. But what those guys are able to do is pretty crazy. It's downright impressive, and maintaining that level of mental focus too. I think about, those of you, not me, those of you that are good at poker, where you can stay focused until you're at the final table, and then continue to stay focused until you've won or lost. Whereas a lot of us just go, all right, I'm good. I played well. Like, I'm just going to go all in. One way or another, I'm going home.
Right.
The amount of focus and competitiveness and desire to do what they do for as long as they do it just astonishes me. And it really, it's nothing short of impressive.
Yeah, well, you mentioned poker, and of course, maybe you're doing that because the World Series of Poker just finished, and it was a...
I saw that. I did not. I have no research or knowledge.
Yeah, It was a 55-year-old who won it this year, and that was pretty impressive because it has become a young man's game, young women's game, because you have to play for so long. They played for 10 days to get to the final table and then finish it at like 12-hour days. So it's a marathon that, you know, the young kids really have an advantage because they just have more energy and stamina.
Yeah, well, when you have that amount of money on the line, though. You know, and the other thing that you can say about, and this just dovetails into a book that I'm reading, but the other thing that you can say about it is, as somebody gets older, there's more of a premium placed on wisdom and less of a premium placed on things like stamina. And so if you have wisdom and knowledge of the game and you've sort of been there before, that can pay dividends as well. And that's where when you look, and we've been talking about the men's side at Wimbledon for so long, I feel bad that we didn't mention the women's side and Serena Williams. And the women's side, where it was kind of the tale of two ages. You have Serena, who's 37, and then you have Coco, who's 15, who really kind of made her her grand entrance on the global stage at Wimbledon as well.
She sure did. Of course, against Venus, Serena's sister.
I mean, that was where she made her mark.
Yeah, and then to see Serena get to the finals again, I think she's lost double-digit finals of Grand Slams, but won more than that. And so she's had just an absolutely incredible career. Hopefully she'll get to the top of that mountain in terms of number of Grand Slams. But, you know, speaking of the older players again, back to Tiger and the physical side, he had a really interesting comment because obviously with all the surgeries that he's had to go through, all of the stress that's been put over on his body over these last, you know, two decades plus, he's talking about the fact that he's not like he used to be physically, which is obvious. But then for him to give some of the details, you know, he described how back in the day he might go to the range for, you know, 4 hours. Then play 36, then go run like 4 miles, then go to the gym, and then potentially be ready to get up and do it again the next day. And now he has so many physical challenges at this age, and because of what his body's been through, it's like if he can go practice for an hour or two, that's a good day for him.
Right, and the other thing is other things enter into your time. Where if there was a time, I'm sure that he's referring to before kids, like when golf was everything. And now there are other things that are demanding his time, whether it's I have to get on a call and deal with whatever sponsor or you name it. There could be 100 things that are requiring him to take time during a day. And it is, you see it with professional athletes, you see it with musicians, where you have acts that come out with a phenomenal first album because they're in the middle of a real struggle to make it. And, you know, we're going to put everything out there on the line, and we practice so much, work so hard, right now this is a thing, and they get there. And once you've made your millions, it's harder to get album two with the same sort of tone and feeling, you know, where your audience identifies with your struggle. And in the case of, and not to mention the fact that now you're on tour, you're taking time there, difficult to write, it's difficult to be creative. Athletes have the same thing where, like, it is difficult to find. There are a lot of things about it that really become a job and less about a pursuit of a passion.
Yeah, and he took a family trip to Thailand for a couple weeks, so he does have those other priorities, like you mentioned. Of course, you also mentioned wisdom earlier, and he has probably more of that for the folks who are out there playing than anyone, and many thought that that would be enough to allow him to contend. But he just couldn't get going in that first round, and he played much better today. He ended up shooting 1 under, but he was 3 under for most of the day. He just had a couple bogeys coming in. But so 1 under today puts him at plus 6
cut is probably going to be around plus two, so he won't be around for the weekend. But one of the other older players who had some really fascinating moments already was Darren Clark, who is from Northern Ireland. So he's another one of these hosts of this event. And before I forget, we mentioned Rory. One of the great anecdotes was that Rory first met Darren Clark when Rory was 10 years old at Royal Port Rush, because Darren Clark is a member there. And so he said that was, you know, pretty cool, as he says. And so it's just fun to see where they are now. But, of course, Darren Clark has won the Open before. So he got to go out in the first group on Thursday and hit that first tee shot. And then what was really impressive is how he dealt with the pressure of that moment. He birdied the first hole. So he was able to hit the first tee shot and make the first birdie of anybody in this Open Championship. And then later in the day, you know, we talk about the weather over there, and it was crazy because there were, you'd watch it and it was rain and then sun for 5 minutes back and forth. It was just, it kept alternating, and you're wondering how this is happening. But then he got to hit a shot, and I don't know if you saw the pictures yet, but there's a picture from him behind him hitting an iron shot, and there's a rainbow over the green. And so just incredible for these guys to be able to play the event there after all those years when they never thought there'd be another major tournament in Northern Ireland. And then for him to have those moments is pretty cool.
Was there a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow?
Well, I think he's going to make the cut. Last I checked, he was inside the cut line, so he'll have at least a small pot of gold.
Perfect. So where are we related to an hour?
We're at 58 minutes. This is kind of fun, by the way. Usually I'm over in the other seat, and you see the clock. I don't even see the clock. The only advantage I have on the other seat is that I have a lot of desk space, so I actually have room to put my papers and my notes in case I want to make a note. But you're over here with the board here. There's no room for notes over here.
No, well, I write some things down, but, you know, by and large, I'll sit there and just do the research in the morning and ultimately come up with, you know, you have your topics, I have my topics, I learn as much as I can about the stuff that I don't already know about, so that I can have a somewhat lucid conversation, and then we go from there. But, anytime you want to switch seats, I'm fine with that, too. I don't know, man. It's fun to get to do it, and it's also fun to sit there and go, wait a second, we've been on for an hour and 2 minutes, how's Harry going to cut this show down this week?
So, right.
The other thing, before I forget, we have the play-by-play of that Little League game. If anybody wants to catch it and catch up, it's on the Fox on Sports Facebook page, so you can just go to foxonsports.com, which will redirect you to the Facebook page, and there's a post there that we'll take you to the Google Drive that has it. But I never go back and listen to shows. I never go back and listen to games. I probably should. I was surprised. It was entertaining. The game itself was entertaining. And, of course, it's on our end. It helps a ton if you have material to use.
Yes, yes. And, again, that's Fox, F-O-X-X.
Yes.
FoxOnSports.com.
No.
So, yeah, that's great to know.
Yeah.
All right, Lauren, well, I get to thank you this time. Thank you for joining us from the road. Good luck the rest of the way in New York. And thank you to everyone here, Harry, Colleen, and Bill. Harry, this is our present to you. We're right at an hour right now, so you won't have to edit anything. So
yeah, save that file as an MP3.
Right. That's so all. Thank you all for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you next time. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.